MZTV.
There were two individuals in the history of the human race that God used to demonstrate certain principles, certain truths among the human race. And no, I'm not talking about Adam and Christ in this instance. I am talking about Job and Solomon. Job became a demonstration by God of what happens when God gives you as much evil as you can stand. And Solomon was a demonstration of what happens when God gives you all the good that you can handle. And the strange thing is there's a common denominator here, and it is that all roads lead to God. There is no destruction or desperation associated with evil to the soul yearning for God, and there is no salvation and satiation or satisfaction from all the good you can handle when one is not associated with God. So these are two very important lessons, and these two men did a great service for us. If I had been asked, Martin, which job do you want to volunteer for, the Job job or the Solomon job? I would inquire as to the Job job. Well, we're going to give you as much evil as you can handle. Okay, what's the Solomon gig? We're going to give you as much good as you can handle, as much sex, drugs, and rock and roll, basically. And you're going to be the richest man on the planet, and you're going to have all the wisdom in the world. And it's like, on the average, weighing it out, it would be a close one, really. But I would take the Solomon job. But it is so amazing. We're going to read the first two chapters of Ecclesiastes. This is an amazing testimony of a man who was tested, who was granted, you might say tested, by every good thing that any human being could imagine. Like all the stupid things that humanity pines for, like winning the lottery or being beautiful, having fame, having lots of friends, lots of likes on social media. You know, Solomon had it all. And there have been in the past and now a lot of people in the movie business or in the fashion industry, in the music industry, of course, who have just become desperate people. And we always are shocked by stories of these famous people, rich people, famous people, people who seem to have every good thing going for them, and they're killing themselves or they're destroying themselves with alcohol or drugs. And you wonder, how could this possibly be? Well, all you got to do is read Solomon. Read Ecclesiastes. Solomon's the guy who wrote Ecclesiastes. Read it, and it explains it to you. Solomon is a demonstration that all the good things that we think are good in the world do not lead to God apart from a direct revelation of God and a relationship with God. And on the other side of things, the evil brings people to the end of themselves, and it opens up an avenue to God. And so some very different but and strange but helpful things going on with these two characters. And they both came out of it, but if you look back at it, I would say that Job actually came out better than Solomon did. Job came out, no, he did. He came out much better than Solomon. So that's where the common ground ends, because Job gets everything restored to him, and he realizes that happiness is not found in things or the joys, the pleasures that this world counts as gain. But Solomon also learns that lesson. But he's still agitated about it. There's an agitation with Solomon. Instead of telling you about it, you're going to see it. You're going to read it and feel it between the lines of Ecclesiastes. This is the biggest bitch session in all of Scripture. And I love it. I love it. It's so instructive. And everybody should read this who has any ideas that if I could just have the house of my dreams, if I could just make this much money, if I could just have this job, if I could just have this spouse, if I could just have this many followers on Facebook or whatever. No. Ecclesiastes. And the concordant version, the concordant version of the Old Testament is so rich here and has such unique wording because it is a faithful, it's faithful to the original Hebrew, that you're going to get stuff out of here that you've never gotten before. And if I only get through chapter one, so be it. Oh, before I get started, thank you once again. Thank you to all of you for your kindness, your generosity, and helping me as I'm speaking today. This is Thursday. I'm recording the show, but tomorrow's Friday. As you're watching this, it's Friday, and I'll be flying to Lima at 5 o'clock p.m. My wife Maria and I will be flying to Lima at 5 o'clock p.m. I'll be in touch. I will be in touch. You will know what's going on. The surgery is the 11th, so you're not going to lose track of me. Ecclesiastes, the assembler. This is what Solomon is officially known as. This is an inspired word, the assembler, because he assembled various bits of wisdom from his life, from the world, probably from his father David. This is the son of David. The words of the assembler, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities. This is the start. Nice start. Get right to it, Solomon. Vanity of vanities, says the assembler. Vanity of vanities, the whole is vanity. Vanity meaning empty. We would say with Mick Jagger and the gang, I can't get no satisfaction. And this Solomon character cannot find satisfaction. What advantage has a human in all his toil, which he toils under the sun? One generation goes and another generation comes, yet the earth is standing for the eon. Oh, what he's saying here is that the earth, which is this chunk of rock that has no soul, no spirit, it has an advantage in that it stands for the eon. It doesn't go away, and yet the generations of humans upon it come and go. So I think what Solomon is saying here, if I read between the lines, is it's better to be oblate spheroid than be a human being, because the generations come, the generation goes. Yet the earth, it stays, it stands for the eon. The sun rises, the sun sets, and gasps back to its place. There's a beautiful word in the concordant version. The sun rises and the sun sets and gasps back to its place. Like even the sun is exhausted with the continuity, with the repetitive nature of life. It goes on and on and on. And of course, Solomon is looking at the sun through his own malaise, through his own ennui, and he is importing his sicko attitude onto the hydrogen ball known as the sun. The sun rises, sets, gasps back to its place. This tells you a lot about how Solomon feels when he goes to bed. Even though he's got 500 wives and 500 concubines, the man gasps when he goes to bed. The man is exhausted. The man heaves a heavy sigh. See, he doesn't say that, but I am reading between the lines because he's importing that. He's imposing that upon the sun without admitting it himself. Not even he can come to admit that for everything I have, I can't wait to go to bed, and I just sigh in exasperation and can't wait for unconsciousness to hit me. That's me reading the seams of the fastball here. Why does the sun do this? That it may rise there once more. And so this is how he feels when he gets up. Another day. My friend Matt Rohrbeck, I hope he's watching this. You've heard of the famous saying, another day, another dollar? Matt Rohrbeck had a twist on it. He would say, another day, another holler. I see that between the lines here with King Solomon. Sun rises, sun sets, gasps back to its place, that it may rise there once more. Going to the south and turning around to the north, around and around the wind is going. Yet on its courses, the wind returns. And again, it's the killing nature of the repetitiveness of life. Verse 7, all the water courses are flowing to the sea. All the rivers, all the lakes, they all empty into the sea. Yet this is not filling the sea. To the place from which the water courses are flowing, there they are returning to go forth again. There's a lot of science and meteorology in between here. But basically, I think Solomon's mourning the evil of evaporation. That the water evaporates from the ocean, it falls as rain, and it goes back to the water courses, the fresh water, that is, the rivers and the lakes, then all flows to the sea again, and it evaporates, comes up, and the whole cycle goes over again. I'm reminded of, seems like of a illustration I saw in a science book in grade school of this whole cycle that water takes, right? Taking up into the sky via evaporation, flowing back to the earth via condensation, and then going back to where it came from. Verse 8, all the words are weary. A man cannot utter it. Not even a man like Solomon, who asked God for wisdom, and God gave him wisdom. Remember? A little brief history. God asked Solomon, I'll give you whatever you want. Boy. And Solomon's answer was classic. It was great. He could have chosen all the riches in the world. I can't remember if God gave him a multiple choice test on that. I can't remember if there was like A, B, C, D, or E, all of the above. But anyway, Solomon chose wisdom. And God said, thou choosest well, grasshopper. And because he chose well, God gave him the riches as well. So Solomon had all the wisdom in the world and all the riches in the world as well, because he asked for the good thing. Asked for the good thing. And yet here he is. All the words are weary. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not. Here's a marvel. This is true. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That is a frustrating reality. No matter how much your eye desires to see good, and it does, and there is lots of good that comes to our eyes and reports the vision to our brains, and we are pleased by it, and yet it always begs for more. It's not satisfied. The eye's not satisfied with seeing. This is why sometimes the strange thing is that people who are blind, they have an appreciation of things. They have an insight. They are able to intuit many things that seeing people can't, because they've retired. They've been retired from this phenomenon of never being satisfied with the seeing. So that part is given up. And apparently, I think ruminations of the mind are much to be valued over what the eye sees, because it's also transient. It always changes. That's why the eye is always looking for something else, nor is the ear filled with hearing. The same thing happens with deaf people. You know, aren't you terrified to think of someday being deaf or being blind? And yet the deaf are so, they're very quiet people, very contemplative people, and they have, again, an insight into things. They detect things that other people can't, because their other senses are sharpened, and their mental acuity is sharpened. So, you know, we think that we have everything, and it is a blessing to be able to see and hear. Yet here's Solomon saying, eye's not satisfied, the ear's not filled. So it's this constant frustration with those who can see and hear. Verse 9, what occurred once, it shall occur again. And what was done, it shall be done again. There is nothing at all new under the sun. Yeah, that's where that famous saying comes from. There's nothing new under the sun. That came from Solomon. He's the one who said it. And that's the problem with the eye and the ear. The eye is always looking for something new. The ear wants to hear something new. This was the affliction of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers on Mars Hill, encountered by our dear Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 17. They just wanted to hear something new. But since this is the wisest man on earth writing this, and he's inspired by the Holy Spirit, something tells me that the ear of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers was never filled. They couldn't get enough, and it didn't satisfy them. And they couldn't reach any conclusion. Very few of them. They did not gain wisdom. That's it, see? They did not gain wisdom via the eye or the ear. Because wisdom comes via the Spirit of God, and this wisdom was supernaturally imparted to Solomon. There is nothing at all new under the sun. Is there anything of which one may say, see this, it is new? It's already occurred. This is good. He sets up the reader. Like, there might be something. Here's a question. It's totally rhetorical, but we don't know that yet. Is there anything of which one may say, see this, it is new? And maybe you can imagine people throwing answers back. Well, yeah, there's this, there's that, there's this. This never happened before. Solomon says, it's already occurred. He doesn't even wait for an answer. It's already occurred. He finishes that sentence, it's already occurred in the eons that were before us. In other words, if you think that something might be new, it's already occurred in the eons before us. There is no remembrance. This is awful. I don't understand this. I can only understand this because what this man's about to say is not true. Oh, you know what? At the bottom here in chapter 1, verse 2, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Concordant has a footnote here. I've never seen this before. They're saying that an alternate translation is transitoriness. Transitoriness. And the reference here is chapter 6, verse 12. Let me go to chapter 6, verse 12. Do a bit of a live study here. Transitoriness. That's interesting. 6, 12. Let's start with 11. When there are many words, the vanity increases. This guy is not happy. What advantage is that to human? Verse 12. For who knows what is good for a man in life during the number of days in his transitory life? You know, of course, we know that life is transitory. The life of this eon is passing. But why the concordant puts that next to vanity, I'm not quite sure. There must be some relation between the emptiness and the transitoriness. Things are moving in and out of our lives that nothing can stick. Let's go back to chapter 1, verse 11. There is no remembrance of former generations. Like I say, I can only attribute this to somebody who's just so ticked off that he doesn't care that what he's saying is not literally true. There is no remembrance of former generations. Of course there is. We remember former generations. We're reading a letter written by a man in a former generation. And also for those who shall come after us, a remembrance of them shall not continue. Well, that's not, this is just not true. Assembler. So I think that in his darkness, but this is the confusing thing, is that he's given wisdom. So he should see through this. He shouldn't be saying something that's not true. There's no remembrance of former generations. There must be something that I'm not seeing here. There is no remembrance of former generations. And also for those who shall come after us, a remembrance of them shall not continue with those who shall come afterward. I'm at a loss to explain that. I was going to attribute it to the guy just has a bad attitude. But now I have to default to, well, wait a minute, this man has more wisdom than anyone's ever been given. So that tells me there must be some truth in this. And maybe the remembrance is something deeper than what I'm now realizing. Don't get it. Verse 12, I myself, the assembler, came to be king over Israel. Now he's giving a history of his career. Came to be a king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my heart to inquiring and exploring by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens. And here's his conclusion. It is an experience of evil. This is one of the most helpful verses in the scripture. You've heard me quoting this many times. It is an experience of evil Elohim has given to the sons of humanity to humble them by it. This is the result of Solomon applying his heart to inquiring and exploring by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens, and that all would include good and evil. And he comes to this conclusion. This is verse 13 of chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. It is an experience of evil Elohim has given to the sons of humanity to humble them by it. And that is the purpose of evil. Besides contrast, we know that evil is necessary for a contrast against good. We can't know good unless we have evil. But also here is another huge, unmistakable purpose of evil. It is given to the sons of humanity to humble them by it. And concerning the movie stars I talked about earlier, the recording stars, the famous people, the glitterati. They are given an experience of evil. They overdose on drugs. They have to go to rehab. They lose all their money. Something evil happens to them, and they come to a humility that they've never had before because of the evil. It takes more evil to humble some people than it does others. I've always been thankful and grateful to God that I've been a sensitive soul. Sometimes it's painful. I know many of you feel the same way. Like, you're so sensitive and everything bothers you and you're just always second-guessing everything. Don't bemoan that, because that means that God doesn't have to clobber you over the head with a 2x4. He can just nudge you with an elbow and say, hey, and the smallest of thing, and you're boom, you're back on track. You see, the earth at large needs more than that. It's going to take the tribulation to bring them to the proper humility for them to grasp God. Verse 14, I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and behold, the whole was vanity and a grazing on wind. Grazing on wind. What do the cattle do? They graze. What do they graze on? Not the wind. They graze on grass for their sustenance. Grazing on wind is a terrible thing. It's like chomping at nothing. It's like being hungry, hungry, hungry for more. I want more. And you just bite through it. There's nothing there. Nothing substantive. We've all experienced that. Things that you thought were substantive. There's nothing there. It's worthless. Saul found that out as a Pharisee. I found it out as a man learning to write, learning the craft of writing back in the late 80s, having some articles published in some big newspapers. I had a dream of being a famous writer, being on the New York Times bestseller list. And I came to find out that the New York literary world is grazing on wind. There's nothing there. There's nothing of substance. It can only disappoint. The accolades of humans will always disappoint. And anyone looking for success in this world, it's like grazing on wind. You're looking for satiation, you're looking for nutrition, and you find emptiness, you find nothing. It's like a cow grazing on wind, and we're all a bunch of cows trying to find satisfaction here. It's not working, is it? And so what do? We read the scripture, we read Paul, we read Ecclesiastes. You watch this show, and you watch other shows, and thank God there are people who are serving you meat, and we're not just grazing on it. Oh, we're devouring it. We're chomping down on it and digesting it, and it's giving life to our bones. Verse 15, what is distorted cannot be set in order. Oof. And what is lacking cannot be counted. This man said more things are lacking in the world. I've thought this. This is really heartening to hear this man with all this wisdom saying things that I have suspected. The things that are lacking, it's like for all the things we have, and I look at all the blessings I have. I have a wonderful wife. I have you. I live in a nice part of the country where the weather is accommodating. And yet, the things that are lacking cannot be counted. It's like, count your blessings one by one, right? Isn't that an old hymn? Count your blessings. And I do. I really do. I had great parents. I mean, there's so many things to be thankful for. I can count them. And yet, what is lacking cannot be counted. And so if we got down to reality and said, let's take an assessment of the good that we have and the things that we don't have, there are many more things that we don't have. And I'm not talking about frivolities, baubles, bangles, and bright, shiny beads. I'm talking about things of substance, things that would help us. Even wisdom. But with all the wisdom he had, Solomon still felt he was lacking, and he was. Because whatever dose of spirit it took this man to be the wisest man on earth, I say the bar was fairly low. To be the wisest man on earth probably didn't take much, because everyone on the earth was stupid. So Solomon was one step above stupid, and therefore he was the wisest man on earth. So even then he was lacking. Obviously he didn't have the wisdom of God, because I can't picture God writing this. What is lacking cannot be counted. What is distorted cannot be set in order. That's how I feel whenever I tried to do any home repair. Back in the day, my wife would say, the sink needs fixed. I would say, what is distorted cannot be set in order. Honey, the door squeaks. What is distorted cannot be set in order. Cannot be, I say. She'd say, what are you talking about? Talking about Ecclesiastes 1:15. Verse 16, I spoke with my heart, saying, behold, I have grown great and have added in wisdom over all who were over Jerusalem before me. See, it's relative. There it is. The wisdom's relative. I have grown great and have added in wisdom over all who were over Jerusalem before me. Never saw that before. Never saw that before. I was just hypothesizing to you that it's probable. In fact, it can't be any other way that this wisdom was relative. And now here it is. I have grown great and have added in wisdom over all who were over Jerusalem before me. Well, your dad wasn't too freaking smart. No, David wasn't very smart. My heart has seen much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied my heart to know wisdom as well as to know about raving and frivolity. Oh, this guy was a raver. And he set out to learn about raving, like to be crazy, to go crazy. I remember a sign at the college I went to in 1978, Hocking Technical College in Southern Ohio. I was a geeky kid. I didn't party at all, but I remember the sign on the dorm. It was Lang Hall, the dormitory I was going to be staying in, and I saw a big sign. I was there, study hard and party hardy. That's all these college kids think about, I thought to myself. And it's true. I think today they just all want to party. They study frivolity, raving and frivolity. Frivolity, frivolous things, things that don't really matter. Obsessing over things that don't really matter. We're surrounded by these people. Solomon said, I'm going to experiment with this stuff just to see what happens. Just going to, you know, that was his excuse. Just going to see. God sent me to experiment with frivolity and raving. So I have to do it. God, this is part of my job. Just doing my job. And he had a point. You couldn't argue with the man. I realized that even this, it is grazing on wind. There you go. What a phrase. It's got to be my favorite phrase so far, grazing on wind. For in much, here it is. I'm about to stop after chapter 1 here. Verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation. That explains so much of our misery. Because we have way more, think of this. We have way more wisdom than Solomon. Way more wisdom into the ways of God. The secrets of the eons that were disclosed by Paul. Solomon couldn't have known those. God's purpose of the eons to reconcile all through Christ. He would have said, Christ, who's Christ? What's Christ? The cross, didn't know anything about it. But for the wisdom he had, even that was vexing to him. It caused him problems. So how much more we now have because of our wisdom that exceeds the wisdom of Solomon. Wisdom does bring vexation. Number one, because you're surrounded by people who are not wise, don't understand the plans of God, who graze on the wind and try to get nutrition out of it, who are still concentrating on raving and frivolity. And so we're vexed by those people. And we're also vexed by having all these promises of God that we know are going to come to pass, and yet they're delayed. They are delayed and delayed and delayed, and it makes the heart sick, right? Solomon said that as well. Hope delayed makes the heart sick. The last phrase here in chapter 1, and he who adds knowledge adds pain. He who adds knowledge adds pain. So we have gotten so much knowledge here at the end of this show, MZTV 1751, that I instruct all of you to take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning.